Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It's the 2nd of September 2013, and today we're joined on the line by Sharmeen Narwani, a commentator and political analyst who examines events in the Middle East. She can be found at many different outlets. Her writings can be found at many different outlets online, including the Huffington Post, Al Jazeera, Al Akbar, and other outlets besides. So, Sharmeen Narwani, it's great to have you on the program today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, James.
Excellent. Well, let's start by talking about what is on the tip of everyone's tongue when it comes to what's happening in the Middle East right now, which is, of course, Syria. And unfortunately, our attention is being drawn there in a rather spectacular way at the moment as the United States and France and others ponder the possibility of military intervention. So let's start to examine this conflict and what's really happening here at a deeper level. Sometimes it's posited that this is really some sort of Syrian civil war or some sort of internal action that's taking place there. But I think we can see this as part of a bigger factional struggle that's taking place. Perhaps you can set the scene for us. Who are the major players in this, and what is at stake really in this struggle?
Well, I think to set the stage for what's happening now or has been happening in the last 2.5 years, it's important to go back a little bit and look at various agendas going on in the Middle East, starting with the Bush administration's yearning to create a new Middle East. And even prior to that, Israeli plans to divide states into smaller states. Key states that threatened Israel's hegemony in the region into smaller states, which would be weaker and not be able to pose any kind of military or political threat to Israel. So, you know, for a long time, for decades now, we've had this building up. And this, what's happening now, is in a sense a final confrontation between a declining empire and, the will for self-determination of many players here in the region, not just governments, but also people, which burst to the scene in early 2011, under the title of what we call the Arab Spring. This basically comes down to, in my area of specialization, is actually geopolitics and looking at the changing, the shift in the balance of power in this region, and this goes before the Arab uprisings as well. So, very interestingly, and I think we all understand that this, in many ways, internationally, is an Iran-America battle. Iran, you could say, leads a block of countries and groups: Iran, Syria, Hezbollah, Hamas used to be part of this group. But frankly, before the Arab uprising, so were countries, newcomers like Qatar and Turkey, two states that became very proactive on the Middle East scene and tended to weigh in on on the side of a regional interest to determine our own destinies and forge our own relationships and alliances outside of what Western powers wanted and mandated and pushed in this region. So you had this bloc. And of course, Iraq is a new entrant into this bloc because the campaign to create a new Middle East actually had unintended consequence of bringing Iraq back into what we call the resistance bloc, that bloc led by Iran. On the other side is a bloc, let's call it the U.S.-led bloc. The Americans are at the helm of this, and alongside are other Western powers, notably Britain and France, who were also U.N. Security Council permanent members, and a whole host of regional states who are backed by the United States. This used to be Egypt and Tunisia and Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and the UAE and Israel and now we're seeing a shift. And I would say U.S. involvement since early 2011 in this region has been, and I quote the New York Times in this, to hinder the growth of influence of Iran during the Arab Spring. So in other words, Iran had an opportunity to take advantage of the fact that a lot of U.S.-backed dictators were falling with this Arab Spring. And whatever the case may be, whatever the U.S. was looking at in the region on that day, they were looking at it through the prism of how they could halt or correct Iran's influence in this area. And Syria comes into play there. Now, I've been covering Syria only since late 2011, so about 9 months into the conflict in the country. And it was a very hard conflict to understand because there was so much information trickling out of the country, mostly on YouTube and through social media, that sounded remarkably like the other uprisings in the Arab world. And so why would you question it? Because, you know, of course, we're simpletons at the heart of things, and one size fits all kind of helps us understand complex situations. The situation in Syria was not so. It was not like Egypt. It was not like Tunisia. It certainly wasn't like Libya, though in a sense it was, because you had plans for unconventional warfare launched on Libya just as they were on Syria. But this is something we realized much later. From the onset of protests in Syria, March 2011, there were armed individuals who were stirring up reactions from the army and other security forces. I'm not saying the security forces did not clamp down. They did. This is a security state. You know, let's not kid ourselves. It always has been. It has been one of the safest countries to travel through because it is a security state and everyone knows everything. But from the onset, there were incidents involving gunmen, which we had not seen in Egypt or in Tunisia, but we had seen very early on in Libya. And of course, this was ignored for much of the conflict in Syria until videos started coming out showing men mostly looking like Islamists, whatever that is, holding guns. And then the excuse became, well, we had to react at some point. This was not the case. This was you know, a classic color revolution, but with weapons from the start. So the if you look at WikiLeaks cables predating the Syrian conflict, you see Americans looking, and this is their language, for every vulnerability that can be exploited, whether it was sectarian or within the regime itself, or within cities, or you name it. Now, Syria has also become an important country for some of the Gulf states who are very frightened by Iran's ascendancy in the region. And these countries, along with now we see a sort of Muslim Brotherhood Muslim Brotherhood flavored Turkey and Qatar. So Turkey and Qatar switch sides from what was more a resistance bloc to the American bloc, okay, in this. And you had Turkey and Qatar, along with Gulf states and Israel, banging on to remove Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. And the reason for this, I mean, it was all rhetorical. I mean, many of these are revolutions by television, you know, or YouTube. So they anticipated a quick fix there because here was an opportunity to exploit vulnerabilities and to use the narratives of the Arab uprisings to push out a president who was critical for the Iran bloc, because Syria is the only Arab state, until Iraq has sort of moved on board, to be part of this Iran-led bloc. And so here was an opportunity to change that. Of course, they miscalculated. Assad was not like the others. He actually did have popular legitimacy within huge parts of the country. And in fact, you know, as much as people like to say, this is not a sectarian war, because while on the opposition, on the armed opposition side, they are mostly Sunni. On the other side, and I'm not saying this is a pro-Assad side, this would be like an anti-violent side. You have many, many Sunni, along with Alawi and Christians and Druze and Kurds now, who were fighting the foreign-backed armed rebellion. So, in a nutshell, this has been a regional or a bloc war from the onset, and Syria has been a very important country to change, and which is why we're entering a new escalation, because many of the Gulf states are quite desperate, Saudi Arabia in particular, to excuse me, to have a very clear solution in Syria, because they now view events there as an existential threat to themselves. Very early on, and I mentioned this in an article I wrote recently, an acquaintance of mine visited some Saudi ministers last year and came back and told me he was quite shocked that the Saudi government, and these are all royals and key royals, this includes the king, view the conflict in Syria as existential. They think that if Bashar al-Assad does not fall, that they will, in short shrift, lose their eastern province, which is Shia-dominated and which is where much of their oil is based.
That's extremely interesting. And while you take a drink of water, I will absolutely. I think you're exactly right to pinpoint this as a geopolitical conflict that's happening on a grander scale than, of course, simply within the confines of Syria itself. And I think it is interesting the way that this maps more or less onto a sectarian religious strife as well. Not perfectly, of course, but there is a Sunni-Shia split that is being manipulated here, I think, for geopolitical purposes. So it is all coalescing in Syria right at the moment, and there's a lot of players at the table, but let's just concentrate there. You bring up Saudi Arabia, and you bring up a recent article that you've written that appears in Al Akbar, which I will link up in the show notes for this conversation. It's called Bandar Ibn Israel, so I will put the link there so people can go and read through this, and I hope they do, because it's a fascinating article about a rather surprising character to arrive on the scene. I don't think anyone, or I certainly wasn't expecting this particular character to be popping up in the Syrian conflict, but we're talking about Prince Bandar, who most people out there will probably know of as Bandar Bush, as his long-standing term as Saudi ambassador to the U.S., earned him that nickname with his close ties to the Bush regime. But let's talk a little bit about Prince Bandar and his connection to this story.
Well, I mean, Bandar is an interesting figure. He's a very controversial figure. He was Saudi's ambassador to Washington for 22 years, and during that time made considerable friendships and relationships throughout the U.S. political and military establishment and with key players from other countries, because Washington is where you send your finest diplomats. And he was, you know, he is known as, I mean, he is the Saudi most influential in the United States. He knows how to grease the wheels. He knows how to twist some arms, and he knows how to get the job done. And he's very much performance focused. He's also been very proactive in a variety of things in the Middle East, including the war on terror, which is ironic because, in fact, Saudi is the, you know, ground zero for a lot of the sponsorship of jihadi and Salafist extremist terrorism around the world. But he was a big proponent of this new Middle East, this plan to create a new Middle East, and a huge proponent of removing Saddam Hussein in Iraq, all of which has backfired. The war on terror is, you know, is a sham. In fact, there is far more terror activity in many, many more cells of Al-Qaeda type or Al-Qaeda related groups today than exist at the time. And also more breeding ground for them, because, you know, they were in Iraq for a while and, you know, Afghanistan, but now in Syria and the Sinai and in Yemen, I mean, and in parts of the African continent, as we see, you know. So Bandar was, he was a very close friend of the Bush family. And in fact, I believe it's George W. Bush, or we call W, who gave him the nickname Bandar Bush because he was so close to the family. Now, he has been controversial, and there have been many rumors about attempted assassinations on him. But the Saudis are quite secretive, so you never really learn these things directly, only through secondary sources. But he because of his controversy and because, in a way, he was a bit of a loose cannon, he has been pulled back by the Saudi establishment from time to time, most notably after he came back from being ambassador in Washington after 2 decades. He sort of disappeared between late 2008 and then 2011 when the Arab uprising started. At that point, the Saudis realized that they needed a real performer, someone who has the relationships with the West, with the Americans in particular, someone who, by the way, advocated for a closer relationship with Israel, because Bandar forged incredibly close relationships with the Israeli political and military establishment while ambassador in Washington. So someone who also has, you know, has controlled and led this wide, broad network of jihadists that the Saudis have always, you know, kept a hold on. So Bandar was brought in to you know, create a Saudi push. Part of this was because when Mubarak fell, the Saudis were very upset. They had pushed the Americans to not allow this to happen and have been instrumental now in getting him released. So they also, you know, didn't want that example set that you could just bring down, you know, influential Arab leaders like this, because they knew they would be next. And the Saudis have led this counter-revolution against the Arab uprising since the start, turning it back in Bahrain, you know, fixing it in Yemen, now infiltrating it in Egypt, trying to create it in Syria, trying to kick it off in Iran, and participating in Libya. So Bandar's the go-to guy, you know, he gets the job done. The thing about Bandar is he is a bit uncontrolled, and he is very ambitious, and he's often been yanked back when things get too hot. Like any great behind-the-scenes operative, Bandar does well in darkness. And now, and especially in the last week or so, increasingly the spotlight has shone on Bandar. And if people are making the connection between political violence in Syria and Lebanon, other areas, and the Saudis directly, you're going to see some nervousness in the Saudi establishment and in Washington, quite frankly, that has a lot of say in what Bandar does. And I would say that the first time we knew Bandar had come on as the new head of Saudi intelligence since the summer of 2012, but he sort of jumped, catapulted onto the media headlines recently this summer when he went to Moscow and visited Vladimir Putin, the Russian president. Now, what's interesting about that visit, other than the many, many leaks that have sprung from it, is that the Russians publicized it. There were cameras and photojournalists. Now, this is pretty much unprecedented. You know, this is the head of a major intelligence agency that the Russians have met on, you know, numerous occasions. He requested a meeting. Normally, he would meet his counterparts, but he requests a meeting with the president. He goes to the meeting, and all of a sudden, the flashbulbs go off. And then, after the meeting, there are numerous leaks. Now, the Russians diplomatically claim that, oh, no, many of these are not true. But in fact, who do you think has been promoting these leaks? So, you know, Bandar's come under the spotlight, which means, and this is what's interesting about what's happened in the region. So it's not just this Iran bloc or Iran-led bloc that's fighting, you know, empire and its proxies in the region, but Syria, the audacity with which many of these players promoted, undermined, and helped destroy Syria, brought in the Chinese and the Russians in a way we have not seen since the end of the Cold War. They essentially blocked all possibility of foreign military interventions in Syria, wrapped their arms further around Iran as well, refusing to allow the UN Security Council to implement more sanctions against that country. And now have become full-time participants. And this is, again, an unintended consequence of American actions. There always is an unintended consequence, or many, and it always works to the detriment of U.S. foreign policy. So by bringing the Russians and Chinese in a way, there's not just, there's international protection, international cover, U.N. Security Council cover, for what the U.S. calls rogue states in the region. And it's frustrated the Saudis a great deal because they haven't been able to then count on the Americans to come in and solve the problems militarily in the region. And because of this, we are now seeing an escalation of political violence in Lebanon and Syria, from car bombings and rockets going in from jihadi groups into Israel. I mean, these are all things, organizations with links ultimately to this large apparatus that of jihadis and Salafi extremists that Saudi controls and pays salaries to and weaponizes. But they've all happened together, which has given us, you know, has brought them to our attention in a way. Had they happened, you know, weeks apart, maybe not so much. But together, you understand what. And Bandar got exactly what he wanted. He got the Americans to announce a potential surgical strike on Syria. Now, of course, that Obama has said, well, I'm going to defer to Congress, which, of course, he won't. If he decides to go ahead, he pretty much will. There is a worry that the Saudis will again come in with their Israeli buddies, this new, you know, cozy relationship to initiate further political violence. So that's, you know, that's Bandar in a nutshell, as far as we know. But the analysis is fairly easy, because when you couple what we know about him and you look at what Saudi interests are and Saudi material capabilities and Saudi desperation, you can see what's happening in the region.
You certainly can. And this is a fascinating and in some ways, I think, horrifying set of developments, because as you say, it does bring the world that much closer to an almost Cold War type block versus power block setting in which tensions are definitely raised to high levels. So it is extremely interesting to see the different pieces being moved around this chessboard and Prince Bandar showing up in Moscow, for example, a very interesting piece of that puzzle. And you allude to the meeting with Putin and the leaks that have come out about that, but perhaps we should put it on the table precisely what Bandar was allegedly offering Putin during that meeting.
Well, I mean, in my article, I go through some of them and I link to the main story. There were two main stories, as far as I know. One was a leak early on that Bandar had promised, had offered to purchase 15 billion dollars worth of weapons from the Russians in exchange for a changed policy on Syria and Iran, which Putin allegedly turned down. The other sort of big leak came through a diplomatic report that was given to As-Safir, which is a very prominent and very credible Lebanese daily newspaper. That was translated by Al Monitor, which actually has some really good articles on the Middle East, fairly new operation. It translates a lot of from the Arabic press that is key, critical, you know, things that we wouldn't read in English. So it's a very valuable service. But it also has a lot of original content that it solicits from people in the region as well as outside, specialists. And Al Monitor translated this As-Safir article, and in it, you know, one of the things that's interesting is Bandar tells, you know, in a way, a soft threat, threatens Putin that, you know, we control the Chechens who have caused problems in Russia, and we can ensure that they don't have any that they can't create a security problem for the Winter Olympics in Russia. And I mean, it's kind of bizarre that he would say that, because he's essentially saying we're behind all your Chechen problem. but he says quite, you know, it's the oddest thing ever, where he talks to Putin and talks about how they share a common interest in fighting terrorism and terror, and then follows with this Chechen threat. And Putin, of course, says, we know very well you're behind a lot of our Chechen problems, the terrorist groups. In fact, that shows to us that you're not really interested in combating terrorists. These are not ideas that go hand in hand, you know, supporting individuals and groups like this and, you know, proclaiming that you support, you know, fighting terror. So he basically gets the boot from that Moscow meeting, and the rest is history, because there have been leaks unlike anything we've seen before.
Absolutely. And again, this becomes more and more interesting as reports begin to emerge of connection between Prince Bandar and the recent chemical weapons attack in Damascus. And so there are reports now that are circulating and getting widespread attention from Dale Gavlak and Yahya Ababne, that who allegedly have interviewed people in Ghouta who are claiming that it was Saudi, specifically Prince Bandar, supplied chemical weapons that were used in this attack. A very interesting piece of this puzzle that's coming together. So let's talk a little bit more about the geopolitical side of this. You mentioned, for example, that Prince Bandar...
If I could interrupt you for a second, please. James, I actually last night spoke with the Yahya, who is the Jordanian journalist who went in and spoke to these rebels and came back with a report for Dale. Dale is, of course, is Jordan-based, has been for about two decades, and writes for the AP, the Associated Press, as well as others sources. So he did, I wanted to know, because I was interested in what the Saudis are doing there. And I know that the Saudis have been funding militant groups who have attacked other rebel groups for at least since early 2012, probably before, because I've written about these groups. So there's, the idea that the Saudis were funding these rebels and weaponizing them is not a surprise. The real surprise is the this new equipment, canisters, and I think what looked like water bottles or gas tanks that were brought in that the rebels did not recognize and were not told very well how to handle. Just simply don't handle them badly, which the father of one of the rebels who then subsequently died and claims one of these exploded in a tunnel, and this is how his son died alongside 11 other rebels, says, now very angrily blames the Saudis for not telling us what these were and what. So we don't know that yet, but I hope to follow up with other interviews with other journalists who went alongside him into Ghouta, and two of them were Western journalists. So let's see how that story develops. But go ahead. You were asking about geopolitics.
Well, no, thank you for that piece of information. That is very interesting. And I'm definitely interested to hear more about that. And hopefully we'll see you writing about that some more in the future as well. But let's talk about the geopolitical aspect of this, because you mentioned that, for example, Prince Bandar has been one of the key Saudi connections, not only to America, but also to Israel and fostering the Saudi-Israeli relationship as part of the coordinated effort to bring in this new Middle East. So perhaps you can tell us a little bit more, what is the Saudi incentive for this new Middle East plan? I mean, I think it's quite apparent what the incentive is for the Israelis, but how about for the Saudis?
Well, the Saudis have been, like I said earlier, they view this as existential. I mean, not only is their big international powerhouse ally, the United States, waning in influence globally, but also in the Middle East. I mean, in Egypt, there was a poll in July taken by James Zogby, who is an American pollster and does a lot of polls in the Middle East. The United States has 1% favorability rating in Egypt. Obama has 3%. That's a huge drop from just a few years ago. So they know that they can't count on the United States to take action, decisive action to change things in the way the Saudis enjoyed during the Bush administration. And I'm talking about George W. Bush here. So that's changed. On another front, these Arab uprisings threaten to remove primarily U.S.-backed and therefore Saudi-backed dictators and governments, which means Saudi Arabia then becomes increasingly isolated. And these uprisings start to move into the Gulf, as we already see in Bahrain and Yemen. And the Saudis will then, it's the end of the Al Saud family. So these are existential times for them. And furthermore, what's even worse is that, bad Iran, bad Shiite Iran, and the Saudis have been fundamentally important in propagating anti-Iran and anti-Shiite narratives since 1979, when the Islamic Revolution took place in Iran, in a terrible way that has really caused divisions and impressions with a whole new generation of youngsters in the Arab world. But I think the way the Saudis and Qataris and Turks and others have pushed these their proxies in these Arab uprisings, meaning the Muslim Brotherhood or Salafists, has created a backlash against political Islam, which you've now seen in Egypt, you know, that has tossed out after 1 year an elected president, a member of the Ikhwan. And you were seeing people in the region rally, okay, against sectarianism and against political Islam, and rally behind national armies, because the military often is the only other institution in an Arab state. So suddenly you see the surge and ascendancy of the military in Egypt, in Syria, even in Lebanon, people calling for the Lebanese military to intervene in these very various crises and bombings and whatever in the state. So that would, backlash against political Islam, Iran emerging as an undisputed power in the Persian Gulf region because it's the largest country. It has the longest borders with the Persian Gulf. The Saudis have always resisted this economically, politically, on oil and gas policy, militarily, where they could. To undermine Iran, because Saudi just becomes another little Gulf state if Iran is allowed to play according to its natural weight in the region.
Just so much to think about here, so much to cover, but I will direct people to your writings, and once again, I will put the link into that article that I mentioned before, but for people who are interested in your writings more generally, what's the best way for them to follow you?
I write mostly for Al Akhbar English now, and if you put the link there, they can find it. So I'm a blogger there. I do some TV and radio interviews, and I do submit to other publications like The Guardian. I have for the New York Times and Al Jazeera in the past, but primarily I'm at Al Akhbar now, where I write analysis, trying to sum up what's happening, because there's so many layers of these things. I have, you know, it's not even the tip of the iceberg here, what we've touched.
No, it certainly isn't. So I hope we can have you back on in the future to continue talking about these very important issues. But we'll leave it there for now. Sharmeen Narwani, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, James, for having me.